Welcome to the Apologia podcast, the audio-only archive of the Apologia YouTube channel. Note that some content was designed to go with visuals, but the imagination can be a powerful thing. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on the podcast app you're using now to help us reach more people. Or, since this endeavor is ad-free, consider going a step further and supporting us for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/apologia. But for now, let's get to the episode. Part of the Apologetic series, posted September 1st, 2023, titled Why Christianity Framed Herod as a Baby Killer, featuring Dr. Jody Magnus. When it comes to bodily fluids in first century Judea...
Oh, yeah, the sanitation regime. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
No one has written more than Dr. Jody Magnus.
Possibly. What? Never heard anybody describe me that way, but okay.
Welcome to Apologia, where a former Christian takes a look at the claims of Christians. We've already covered evangelical YouTube darling, archaeologist Titus Kennedy, on the Old Testament.
Overview of the entirety of the Old Testament.
Unfortunately, this has not gone well, to say the least.
And on the existence of Moses.
Is there actually any evidence for the Exodus?
Well, no. There's no archaeological evidence.
But recently, Dr. Kennedy has been straying into the world of the New Testament. So I'm very excited to be joined by one of the world's leading archaeologists focused on first century Judea, Dr. Jody Magnus.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Magnus is one of 10 world-class scholars who are speaking at the upcoming New Insights into the New Testament virtual conference happening in a few weeks. An exciting 2-day event tailored to people like me who are passionate about biblical scholarship but aren't actually scholars themselves. This is an amazing opportunity and value that I'm not going to miss, but we'll talk about that a bit later. For now, let's get back to the videos.
Is there archaeological evidence to support the life, death, and ministry of Jesus? My guest is Dr. Titus Kennedy. He's an archaeologist. He's a professor with me at Biola University.
Have you come across Dr. Kennedy before?
Not until you sent me the links yesterday. I'm sorry.
No worries.
What we're going to do is we're going to kind of chronologically walk through issues in archaeology related to the birth of Jesus, the ministry of Jesus, the trial of Jesus, culminate in the resurrection. So kind of walk through this chronologically. Dr. Titus Kennedy, you ready to rock and roll?
I am. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Overall, I didn't have any huge objections to anything he said. It all sounded fine. I think he sounded properly cautious and sort of reserved in what he was saying. For me, coming from a different background and a different perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any problem with acknowledging that these were real historical people who had certain titles and who happened to be mentioned in the gospel accounts. I think that the gospel accounts contain a lot of historical references. I mean, I think it's like evaluating any other ancient source, but particularly when you're talking about the Bible, whether it's the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, it's a matter of exactly which pieces of information are reliable or historical. How do you determine which ones are? And just because somebody who is a real historical figure is mentioned doesn't make the entire story historical, right? So there's that as well.
Because there's a lot of fictional stories like the Avengers, for example, that are rooted in real buildings and real times and even real people outside of the Avengers. And of course, that doesn't prove that it's true.
Sure. I don't have any huge problems with any of that. And I mean, I find the gospel accounts and especially the synoptics to be really interesting in terms of shedding light on the world of Jesus, right? Judaism in the time of Jesus. And so that's what interests me the most. But sure, I have a problem with that.
If you don't mind, let's skip to the end, because I've been doing a lot of work on the burial of Jesus of late.
So the burial practices that we read about in the gospels, those connect very well with what we know about practices in first century Judea, and that's to be expected. I don't think that's something that many people would say would be invented by the gospel writers.
You may or may not be aware of this, but it's on this front where you are a darling of Christian apologists.
Jody Magnus, an atheist archaeologist from the University of North Carolina, who I footnote in the book, and others, So she has no theological motivation to say this. Says, yes, the Gospels get it right.
I have no idea.
You wrote, the Gospel accounts of Jesus' burial appear to be largely consistent with the archaeological evidence.
Yes.
And also, the Gospel accounts describing Jesus' removal from the cross and burial accord well with archaeological evidence and Jewish law. You are oft quoted.
Yeah, I look, so I just want to clarify. When I say they're consistent with, they are consistent with. Does that prove the historicity of the Gospel accounts? It doesn't prove that the accounts are historical, but it means that whoever wrote those accounts was familiar with how the Jews of Jerusalem disposed of their dead in the time of Jesus.
To take some emotion out of the topic, would you be willing to entertain some questions about the thieves said to be executed on either side of Jesus?
Okay, what about them? Well, I have never actually thought about them too much, but okay.
According to what you've learned, would the thieves also have been taken down by sundown? Is that something that probably would have happened to their bodies as well?
Yeah, well, in theory, in other words, ideally, according to Jewish law, ideally, even the worst criminals are entitled to a proper burial within 24 hours of death. And so if there was somebody who could have attended to that, then yes. But the fact is that not everybody in the ancient world, including not all Jews, received a proper burial, either within 24 hours or at all. And we have plenty of evidence for that. Let's put it this way. There was nothing to say that they wouldn't have been buried within 24 hours of death, taken down from the cross. But that would have been if there was somebody who would have attended to that for them, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a maybe. Let's say there wasn't someone to attend to them, as you put forth. Who would have taken them down if no one came forward to claim them?
There, I'm just into total speculation
okay.
here. I assume that since they were crucified by the Roman authorities, that at some point the Romans might have removed them from the crosses, but that doesn't mean they would have given them a proper burial. I'm not sure. Maybe they could have just been left on the crosses for a while to, you know. People were crucified, by the way, outside the walls of the city, right?
Right.
So maybe they were just left and then, you know, vultures and animals ate their remains. We know that happened a lot in the ancient world. There's a wonderful passage in Suetonius's biography, Life of Vespasian, where the emperor is dining at his breakfast table and a dog trots in and deposits a human hand under the breakfast table. So there were dogs and other scavengers around that scavenged dead bodies. And so anybody whose remains were not properly disposed of, and apparently that was a not small part of the population, was subject to being scavenged in that way. I mean, this is also, even if you go back earlier, you can think of Jezebel,
mm-hmm.
right? The death of Jezebel,
right.
And how, you know, she's pitched out of the window, right? The second story window plops down onto the ground. And then when they go to bury her remains, all they find are like her hands or something because the rest had been scavenged by dogs. So it was not uncommon, right?
It seems like in the Mishnah and other places that the Sanhedrin had some level of responsibility for burying dead bodies. Do we have any kind of archaeological evidence about the two burial places that they are said to have kept for such criminals? Has that come up in archaeology at all?
Yeah, it's a really good and kind of a complicated question. And the first layer is how applicable is what's in the Mishnah to what's going on in the time of Jesus, that is before 70, right? Because
right.
the Mishnah obviously is a later source. And even with the information that it contains, it's not always clear how much of it is descriptive and how much of it is prescriptive. So even if you say it goes back in time, that's a separate problem.
Okay.
But also the Mishnah's description is referring to, now I'm not saying it wouldn't necessarily apply, but it's actually referring to criminals who were executed by the Sanhedrin for violations of Jewish law. And that's not what's happening in the case of Jesus. Jesus was sentenced to death by the Romans on a charge of treason and not for a violation of Jewish law. So the Mishnah description, even if we take it at face value, is not necessarily applicable to the case of Jesus, right? So there's that problem. And then there's a whole other thing where we actually have physical remains of some unfortunate man who was crucified and interred in a rock cut tomb in Jerusalem. We have the actual ankle bone with the nail through it, and it's actually the only physical remains of a crucifixion victim that's ever been found archaeologically. And so that shows that here we actually do have a case of somebody who received a proper burial in a rock-cut tomb, which is not just some random cemetery like you hear about in the Mishnah. It's a proper family mausoleum, so to speak. I mean, I think that there's a whole problem with that. And then I will say, no, we don't have any archaeological remains of anything like the kind of burial ground that the Mishnah is describing. That doesn't mean that there wasn't something like that.
Sure.
To be able to identify that, you'd in archaeology, you'd have to find some sort of a massive pit grave, or I don't actually, not even that. I'm not sure exactly how you would identify that, short of having inscriptions that explicitly say so. But I will say that I'm not so sure that what the Mishnah is describing was historical. And,
oh, okay.
And the reason is because all of the information that we have about Jewish burials in this period is that if they have proper... Well, here we have to actually go into a whole separate thing about how Jews disposed of their dead, right?
Sure.
So one of the problems I have with the way many of my colleagues, my archaeological colleagues, study Jewish burials of the time of Jesus in the area of Jerusalem is that they focus on rock-cut tombs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not surprising because rock-cut tombs are very visible in the landscape. They're virtually indestructible unless you blow them up. And so they're well-preserved, and about 1,000 of them are documented in the area of Jerusalem, and each one contained a number of spaces for bodies to be placed. But if you take into account that, let's say, again, we have about 1,000 that are documented, let's say that we have maybe a quarter, a fifth, whatever, of the original rock-cut tombs that existed or that we know of, only a fraction of those that existed. Even if you multiply the number that we know by four times, by five times, whatever, and take into account the number of spaces for burials within those tombs, which were used by families over the course of generations.
Right.
These really are, we would call today, a mausoleum, right? Each one belonged to a family and was used by the members of that family over the course of generations. So even if you multiply, and but then you take into account that these tombs were used by members of a family over the course of several generations, so let's say 1st century BC, 1st century AD, you're still coming up far short of the number of tombs that you would need to accommodate all of the population of Jerusalem during that span of time. And that's even if we take a very modest estimate of the number of people who lived in Jerusalem at around, let's say, 60,000 people at any one time. That's a modest estimate, doesn't take into account pilgrims and things like that. So that's why I think it's unfortunate that many of my archaeological colleagues focus on rock-cut tombs to the exclusion of everything else. And we know, in fact, that throughout the ancient world, and you go to other places, like you go to Greece, you look at Rome, you look at the evidence, you see that everywhere around the ancient world, there were always different kinds of burial customs, which basically reflected the means of the individual or the family. So if you were wealthy, you had a big mausoleum that was flashy and located in a prominent position. But if you weren't so wealthy and you were lucky enough, your family might, or friends or whatever, might dispose of you the way we bury our dead today, actually, or what I call a trench grave, mm-hmm. which is how we think Jesus would have been disposed of if he had been given a proper burial, but not placed in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, according to the story. And then, of course, there were many people, unfortunate people, who had nobody to attend to them when they died. Maybe those two thieves
right.
crucified on either side of Jesus, right? Who didn't have anybody to attend to them and whose remains got scavenged. Or we have plenty of sources, including rabbinic literature, which refer to human remains being deposited in empty cisterns or pits or whatever. Same thing, by the way, in Rome, for example. So actually only a small part of the overall population received a burial that would still be visible in the archaeological landscape today. And the vast majority of people were disposed of in a way that left very few, if any, traces in the archaeological record. And so that's one of the problems with understanding the Mishnah's evidence. Then one of the problems that I have is that when we do have evidence of people being buried together, right, in some sort of like a mausoleum or rock-cut tomb or something like that, they're in family groups. And they're not buried according to what they were executed for or, you know, whatever. They're buried as families. Even a little later at Beit Sha'arim, which is a gigantic Jewish necropolis in the northern part of Israel and Galilee, which dates to the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, so after 70. And there you start to get slightly different burial customs, and it's a very large catacomb. So there you do get people buried who are from all different kinds of places and families and things. But even there, what you see are clusters of families who acquire a part of the catacomb. So I'm not sure that what the Mishnah is describing is really historical. I'm not ruling out the possibility, but again, we don't have anything in the archaeology that corresponds with what it describes.
Gotcha.
That's not so surprising, right?
Right.
You know, it's actually interesting. So coming back to there is actually a passage in Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, where he refers to a situation during the time of the first Jewish revolt against the Romans in Jerusalem, where the Romans were crucifying rebels outside the walls of the city. These happened to be Idumeans, so they were Idumean Jews. They were Idumeans who had been converted to Judaism at some point. And he actually refers to the Jews taking care to get the bodies from the crosses and bury them within 24 hours. And so that indicates that there certainly were cases. I don't know that this happened all the time, but there was somebody who sometimes was concerned to take these bodies off the crosses. He doesn't say any more about who these were. The people who worried about getting these bodies off the crosses and burying them, were they just random groups of Jews who were worried about that? Or were they some friends or relatives or something like that? We don't know. And by the way, in the Roman world, there were burial societies. People joined. People paid.
Wow.
I'm a member I'm a member of our local Rotary Club, by the way. So it's kind of like that, actually, in that you paid your membership, right, in a burial society in order to ensure that when you died, your remains would be properly disposed of.
Oh, this is so much better than what I had imagined. Yeah. I thought they were getting together on Friday night and just burying people.
Okay. No, not now.
Okay.
No. And so.
Oh, so this is like a timeshare situation.
That's right. It's like a timeshare.
Yeah.
So again, because people knew, at least, especially, I suppose, if your family didn't have like a big mausoleum where you knew you would be interred after you died, you wanted to make sure that your remains were properly disposed of, right? And so people formed those kinds of burial societies.
All right. Well, thank you for taking on my pet passion. Let's see if Titus touches on any of yours.
So we've got King Herod the Great. Now, he's a very well-known figure. I don't think hardly anyone is going to dispute his historical existence, but he's presented as a king with a title of king, right? Now, we can look in Josephus and see that, of course, too, but on his coins, Herod had some very, very interesting things. Like, he calls himself King Herod on those coins. So he has the title of king, just like we see in the Gospels. It's not a governor. It's not some other title that he had. It was elevated to the position of king. And Herod also has some other interesting aspects on his coins. One of them shows this helmet with the star on it. And it seems to be a Roman symbol, perhaps for the Dies Irae, but it also has some sort of messianic interpretations too.
Beyond just this coin, what can you tell us about Herod and what he thought about himself?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. That's one of my favorite things that I've done recently. But I will say about that coin, and I've written about that particular coin, I connected with a mint in Samaria at the time I wrote that paper about it, which was a long time ago. I didn't connect it with messianic expectations. I would be a little reluctant to do that now. I actually connected it with a cult of quarry at Samaria because it's the Kappa the Dies quarry, and there are stone blocks from a temple or shrine to quarry at Samaria that have that same design on them. So anyway, I would actually be a little, hesitant to make that leap. But the recent paper that I wrote, which was published in 2019, is about Herod's tomb at Herodion. Herod the Great ruled from 40 BC until his death in 4 BC. And Josephus tells us that when Herod died, and he died in his winter palace at Jericho, his body was brought to Herodium for burial. And so we know that Herod was buried at Herodium. It happens to be the only site that we know of. There's one other possible candidate, but let's ignore that. That Herod built and named after himself. He built a lot of things, and he always named everything that he built after somebody, in honor of somebody, like, Caesarea, which he named in honor of Augustus or whatever. But Herodium is the only place that he put his own name on. And it's a fortified desert palace, very close to Bethlehem, and actually I'm practically spitting distance of Bethlehem.
Wow, okay.
A tower, literally, it towers over Bethlehem. And so it's interesting because apparently Herod named Herodium after himself because he intended it to serve as his everlasting memorial, right? It's his monument to himself. Now, Josephus tells us that Herod was buried at Herodium when he died, but he doesn't say where the tomb was located. That's a big site. It's a mountain, actually. Herod literally created an artificial mountain there. And finally, in 2007, the late Israeli archaeologist Ehud Netzer and his team found the tomb, which is a mausoleum, halfway up the side of the mountain, more or less on the side facing towards Jerusalem. And in so the paper that I wrote about this, what I say is, in my opinion, the discovery of Herod's tomb at Herodium is the most important discovery in this region since the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Wow.
You know, the Dead Sea Scrolls have been described as the most important archaeological discovery of the 20th century. I think that Herodium is the next one after that for this century. And the reason I think that is because we have no direct sources of information on Herod in the sense that we have no writings that he wrote.
Right.
All of our information about Herod is filtered through other sources. So our main source is Josephus, who drew his information, who was born 4 decades after Herod died. So he wasn't alive during the time of Herod. He is drawing on his information from various sources, primarily the lost biography of Herod written by Herod's court biographer Nicolaus of Damascus. So we know that Josephus was taking a lot of information from there, but we don't know what he did with that information because we don't have the original. So we have Josephus, we have scattered references to Herod in other sources. We have the New Testament, of course, right? The massacre of the innocents in Matthew, and then some scattered references also in ancient Jewish sources, whatever. Pretty much all of our information about Herod from these written sources is negative, presents Herod in a very negative light. And what's important about the discovery of Herod's tomb, in my opinion, is that now we get to see Herod in his own eyes and to see him in the way that he wanted to be remembered and memorialized. The message that he is giving us unfiltered directly after 2,000 years. And so I wrote this paper about the mausoleum, and it has, so again, I'll just distinguish and say the mausoleum is the structure in which Herod's remains were placed, or his remains were placed next door or something. It's basically the structure that marks the spot where Herod was buried, and it's located partway up the mountain, just to be clear about the terminology of mausoleum.
Gotcha.
So it turns out this mausoleum is a kind of a freestanding monument with a kind of a tall elevated square podium. It's all made out of stone. And on top of that tall raised podium was a circular structure, which is called a tholos. Tholos is just Greek for circular structure.
Okay.
Surrounded by 18 Ionic columns. Ionic columns are the kinds that have the little curly Q capitals. And then on top of that, a kind of a conical roof that goes up from there. And so the team that worked with Ehud Netzer and published a really extensive study of the tomb and the mausoleum and pointed out that, you know, there are a lot, and other scholars have also talked about Herodium in this light. How do we situate this kind of structure within the larger Greek and Roman context? And it turns out that, like all of Herod's other buildings and monuments, it's a hybrid. Herod drew on different kinds of traditions, and he makes a unique combination of things. And so he draws on native traditions like Judean traditions or Nabataean, because he was half Nabataean, right? His mother was Nabataean. And on Greek traditions or Hellenistic traditions and on Roman, right? And it all merges together. Without going into all of the different parallels, when you look at what we have at Herodium, it's actually the closest, the things that are closest are the mausoleum of Augustus at Rome, which if some of your viewers have ever been to Rome, they might be familiar with it. It's an enormous structure that's a circular cylinder that originally had a massive pile of dirt around it. So it looked like a cylinder coming out of a mound of earth. And the mound of earth is what's called a tumulus. And then the burials were inside that cylindrical structure. So Herodium is somewhat similar to that in that you have a tumulus, this mountain. Coming out of the mountain, originally there was a circular fortress, so it would have looked actually quite close to what you have at Rome in the mausoleum of Augustus. But then you also have this like separate mausoleum structure on the side of the mountain, the side of the tumulus at Herodium. And where is that coming from? That's coming from the Hellenistic world.
Yeah.
And actually the inspiration is indirectly the most famous tomb of antiquity, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, which was the mausoleum at Halicarnassus. That's where we get our word mausoleum from, because somewhere in the middle of the 4th century BC, a king who ruled in the area of what is today the southwest coast of Turkey, ancient Halicarnassus, modern Bodrum, died. His name was Mausolus, and he was buried in an enormous monument that consisted of a huge square elevated podium that had a temple-like structure on top, surrounded with columns. And that Tomb Monument became so famous that ever since then, monumental tombs have been called mausolea.
Well, there you go.
After the mausoleum in Halicarnassus. So what happens when the mausoleum in Halicarnassus is built and it becomes famous is that rich and famous people all around the Mediterranean world start to build their own versions. And we also see this even in Judea before the time of Herod. But so that's basically like when you talk about this mausoleum on the side of Herodium, you know, that's the ultimate source of inspiration. But there's something a little weird about it. And what's weird about Herod's mausoleum is that the other mausolea, generally, when they had a building on top of the raised podium, it was a rectilinear or square building surrounded with columns, something like a little temple, okay, kind of, right? With a pitched roof. In Herod's mausoleum, it's circular. It's a tholos. And that's unusual. And again, it's surrounded by 18 Ionic columns. And this is where I came in, because I noticed, I'll take credit because I think it's just, I was so happy that I noticed this, right? There is a very famous ancient tholos that had 18 Ionic columns around it. And 18 Ionic columns is significant because, again, if your viewers are familiar with Ionic capitals, Ionic columns are basically columns that at the top have the capital as the thing at the top of the column. And they have these little curly Q things that look like rolled up scrolls,
right, yep,
on either side of the top, right? That kind of a column, that kind of a capital is not well suited to a circular structure because Ionic capitals have two sides.
Right.
So if you use them, you want to use them in a rectilinear structure, not a circular structure. Circular structures would be much better off with a Doric column, which is just like a simple cushion, or with a Corinthian capital, which is the one with the leaves carved all the way going around. But Ionic doesn't fit circular structures. So you rarely find tholoi circular structures that are surrounded with Ionic columns. But there's a very famous one again, and it's surrounded not just with Ionic columns, but with 18 Ionic columns, which is exactly what we have at Herodium. And that is a structure called the Philippian at Olympia. So Olympia in Greece is the site of the sanctuary of Zeus. And there, the father of Alexander the Great, whose name was Philip, build a structure inside the grounds of the sanctuary. This is unusual, to honor himself and his family after he defeated the other Greek city-states in this big famous battle. So he establishes it's kind of a victory monument inside the grounds of the sanctuary, inside the sort of perimeter, but also with statues of himself and his family, his wife, and Alexander was there, his son Alexander, on the grounds of the sanctuary. And it's something that is not usual in ancient Greece in this period, this sort of merging of a mortal Greek ruler with the idea of divinity, because again, it's inside the sanctuary. And this is something that becomes much more pronounced with Alexander the Great, this kind of a mortal Greek ruler becoming worshipped as divine. So then you might say, well, how would Herod have actually even known of the Philippian, right? Where, what's the connection? Well, it turns out that Herod, when he visited Rome in 12 BC, returns to Judea by way of Olympia. And at Olympia, he bestowed on Olympia, which was in decline at that point. I'm sure your listeners know the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Olympic Games are called the Olympic Games because the very first games were held at Olympia in the year 776 BC. So by this point, though, Olympia is in decline. The games are in decline. And Herod bestows a huge amount of money on Olympia and to keep the games going and all sorts of other stuff. And they actually made him an honorary president for life. And then he goes back to Herodium. And guess what? That's when that little mausoleum is built with the 18 Ionic columns. So if we look at the mausoleum in the form of Herodium in its larger context, it's making connections both with Augustus, but also with Alexander the Great. And it's not an... I know it sounds like I'm going on and on, but I'm actually greatly oversimplifying the whole thing.
I believe it.
Yeah. But at any rate, what's interesting is that both Alexander, and Alexander was the prototype of these sort of rulers in the Hellenistic and Roman worlds. Everybody emulated Alexander. So Alexander and then these later rulers like Augustus or whatever, they're all emulating him. And that means that they're not just rulers. They're ruling with sort of this idea that they're either divine or they become divine. They become deified after their deaths, one or the other. And by emulating these other monuments, Herod is making a statement. He's placing himself directly in that tradition. The message that he is sending is he is comparing himself and his dynasty, which he hopes to establish, to Alexander the Great, to Augustus. Now, any non-Jew in the Greek and Roman world would have looked at this and said, makes perfect sense. But for the Jews, that would have been a big problem, right? That you have a mortal ruler, first of all, claiming to be divine.
Right.
Right? Jews didn't accept that. But even the idea of Herod as a legitimate king would have been a problem in the eyes of many of the Jews that he ruled over, because he was not descended from the native Jewish dynasty, the Hasmoneans. He wasn't even fully Jewish, right? His mother wasn't Jewish. So he was Jewish on his father's side of the family through forced conversion. How Jewish he was considered, it depends on who you ask. But anyway, okay, but so to try and claim that he's a legitimate king when he's not even fully Jewish, when he's appointed by the Romans, an outside power, to be king of Judea, right, is to establish himself in the eyes of his Jewish population, to establish his legitimacy. Well, what's the best way to do that? You want to connect yourself to David.
Right.
Because if you connect yourself to David, who is, of course, the royal Messiah. What does it mean, royal Messiah? Not a god. It means the royal anointed one, right? The legitimate king in the line of David. If you can connect yourself to David, then you can legitimize yourself as the king. And that is apparently what Herod tried to do. And already many years ago, an Israeli scholar, Avraham Shalit, wrote a book about Herod, and it's not read that much by a lot of people because it was written in German and translated into Hebrew. I think that's the order. I read the Hebrew, not the German, but it was never translated into English, which is kind of too bad. But he actually made this observation. He suggested that Herod claimed to be the fulfillment of the expectation of a Davidic Messiah, which was apparently a widespread expectation already at that time. And we see that also in the gospel accounts. And he did this by, among other things, he doesn't talk about the tomb at Herodium because that, of course, had not been found yet. But Shalit makes this connection by pointing out that there's, in particular, one passage in Josephus where Herod claims to rule by the will of God. It's God's will that I have been appointed king. And what Shalit says is we see that Herod is presenting himself as the fulfillment of the expectation of a Davidic Messiah by rebuilding the Jerusalem temple on a massive scale where he actually outdoes Solomon, right? And what Herod then does is he plugs into the existing sort of Roman environment of an era of peace and prosperity, this sort of golden age in the time of Augustus.
What have the Romans ever done for us? Brought peace? Oh, peace! Shut up!
And Herod then says, it is through the agency of the Romans that we are in an era of peace and prosperity, thanks to the Romans appointing me king, right? And so he's like, okay, and now with Herodium, we can look and see what's going on here. And one of the things that I had long asked myself, and this was long before the mausoleum was discovered, is why Herod had himself buried at Herodium. I couldn't figure it out. You know, of all the places, he could have been buried anywhere. Why on that spot? And then finally, it all made sense because it overlooks Bethlehem. The connection to David, right? You want to connect yourself to David. Bethlehem is the birthplace of David. Look at the trouble that the gospel writers go to connect Jesus to David by way of Bethlehem, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, he's from Nazareth, but no, actually, he's from Bethlehem, right? So I think that the placement of Herodium, among other things, was intended to visually connect Herod with the birthplace of David. And again, I think it's a statement. So I think that you have two things going on here with the mausoleum. On the one hand, you have Herod situating himself in this sort of royal, dynastic, and divine line of rulers from Alexander and then going through Augustus by way of the way that he constructs his final resting place, but also for the Jewish side then, laying claim to having fulfilled the expectations associated with the Davidic Messiah. And as you know, I have colleagues who are like, oh, this just sounds so far-fetched, right? That Herod would have claimed to be Messiah, that anybody would have actually believed this. But then in the gospel accounts, we get references to this group called the Herodians.
You do.
And who are these weird Herodians, yes, right? Who you hear about with the Pharisees and this and that, right? And nobody knows, there's no agreement about who this group is, although a lot of scholars think that they're some sort of a group of the elite that were aligned with Herod, and therefore they're called the Herodians. But what's really interesting is that we also get references, quite a few actually, to Herodians in later literature. From about the year 200 AD on, we have a series of ancient authors, beginning with Pseudo-Tertullian, who's not actually necessarily an individual, but that's a whole other thing. But anyway, going on through there, these ancient authors who call them a Jewish sect, called the Herodians, who believed that Herod was the Messiah. That's how they're defined in these authors starting from around the year 200. If we can retroject that back to the New Testament, then it goes all the way to the first century. That's a little bit of a leap. But what it means is that by the time you get to the beginning of the third century and then going on from there, there were Christian authors who believed that there was a group that there had been, whether or not they existed or whatever, but they write about them. And some of them, like Jerome, actually, you know, seem to be threatened by this, you know, oh, this is a group that thinks that Herod's the Messiah, whereas actually the Messiah is Jesus, right? So it appears that the idea that Herod not only claimed to be the Messiah, but actually that there were people who accepted that claim, that that is something that's real. And now we go back to the way Herod chose to memorialize himself in his mausoleum and his tomb at Herodium. It all fits together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Although I'm wondering now if that makes it more or less likely that he killed infants in Bethlehem.
Oh, right. So then you get to that. So I don't know whether that episode in Matthew, the Massacre of the Innocents, whether it actually happened or not, right? There's, again, scholars disagree. Many scholars think that it's a fabricated story, right? That it never happened, that it is inspired by Herod's reputation for having his own sons put to death, right? That's where it goes. So I don't know whether that actually happened or not, but I do think that the story as presented in the Gospel of Matthew reflects one reaction to Herod's claim. The reaction is, because one of the things in that passage that the author of the Gospel of Matthew does is he keeps repeating Bethlehem, 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 and that Jesus is from Bethlehem and Jesus is the legitimate Messiah. And so Herod is presented as not just not the Messiah, right? Not the legitimate Messiah, but Herod is basically an antichrist who tries to have the true legitimate Messiah put to death.
Exactly.
So I think that the story is one reaction among one Jewish reaction to Herod's claim. So clearly, different groups of Jews reacted differently to Herod's claim. So you have, I think that there was probably a group, whether they were called the Herodians or not, who accepted Herod's claim. And they were probably members of the elite. They were probably in his circle because they benefited from being in Herod's circle. But then there were obviously other Jewish groups that opposed this claim. And I think that's the reaction that we see in the story of the Massacre of the Innocents.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's really cool. One day when I have time, I hope to go back and continue working on that and expand it, because it's just like it started to go off in all sorts of directions and I had to like cut it at some point.
But, right.
Yeah.
One of the things we wanted to do today is get word out about the New Insights into New Testament conference hosted by Dr. Bart Ehrman, where you're one of the stars of the show. Your lecture is called In the Footsteps of Jesus, Exploring Jerusalem's Sacred Sites. What will you be covering?
Yeah. Thank you for asking. Look, I don't have that much time. Jerusalem is such a huge topic, right? So I obviously am looking for connections here with Jesus. So mainly focusing on the area of the Temple Mount, the area around the Temple Mount, by which I mean, for example, the Antonia Fortress, and then the traditions associated with the Via Dolorosa, meaning the route that was walked by Jesus from the point where he's sentenced to death by Pontius Pilate and picks up the cross, and then to the point where he's crucified. I won't be talking a whole lot about the site of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I won't have time to go into the whole stuff with the burial, but basically those are the things that I'll be talking about. And I'll have to start with a little bit of background about the layout of Jerusalem. You can't just like launch in and start talking about things without people being oriented where things are in the city.
That sounds very cool. I've not heard anything about that before. And Dr. Magnus is just one in the lineup that includes Drs. Mark Goodacre, Candida Moss, Robin Walsh, Bart Ehrman, Jennifer Neust, James Tabor, Hugo Mendez, Dale Allison, and Amy Jill Levine. That's a lot of scholarship for a very little price compressed into just 2 days. Good thing we also get lifetime replay to soak it all in. If this sounds as great to you as it does to me, sign up today at tinyurl.com/BartCon2023, and you'll not only get a lot of learning, but you'll be helping this channel as well.
Final question. Are there any issues you're aware of that seem to contradict or undermine the gospel accounts as it relates to the life, death, or ministry of Jesus?
Oh, wow. What a question. It's a huge question.
Okay.
No, I'm trying to think about how to answer that. So that's not, again, this is not the way that I tend to think about things. With the line of the Via Dolorosa that I'll be talking about is not whether or not it's confirmed by the New Testament, but rather how the tradition that we have today, that is the line of the Via Dolorosa, developed, and how it actually is inconsistent with the information that the New Testament provides.
Ah, gotcha.
Okay, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's the reverse.
Also, I mean, I haven't thought about, you know, affirming or not, like whether things affirm or whether it's silent or not. I haven't actually thought about it like that, because that's not the way that I would think. Because even, for example, if we go back to the very beginning of our talk here and go back to the burial customs, right, and the burial of Jesus, where I say, well, what we have is consistent with what we know about how the Jews of Jerusalem disposed of their dead in the time of Jesus. So affirm is not the word that I would use, right? Just because archaeology indicates that this is consistent, that something may be consistent with archaeological evidence, or that certain individuals are actually historical, doesn't make the story around it true. And so, I mean, I'm not coming from a perspective where I'm looking for that kind of affirmation of the biblical account.
Right.
Coming at this from the perspective of an archaeologist. So for me, the Gospels are one source, particularly the Gospels as opposed to the other books of the New Testament, are particularly informative if we want to learn about the world of Jesus. I'm not saying Jesus is an individual. That's a whole other thing. But the world of Jesus, Judaism in the time of Jesus, it's, to my mind, a very valuable source of information. But that's different from saying we're going to pick out elements here and say that affirms biblical account, if that makes sense.
That's an excellent answer. I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much for your time, Jody. I so much appreciate your work and your enthusiasm.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
For more videos where scholars stop by to help me look at the claims of Christians, tap on the playlist thumbnail on screen now, and I'll see you over there. Until next time, later.